Good morning.
Good morning.
That was about a week ago. Well, in fact, it was a week ago yesterday. In the morning, I went for a walk over by Lake Harriet, which I often try to do. And often when I'm on a walk like that, things will come to me. And I knew that this recitation of the precepts was coming, and I thought, well, you know, I should say something on the precepts this Saturday. But just a couple hours later, I heard on the news that Senator Paul Wellstone's plane had crashed. And whatever I was thinking at the time, I did have some bits of inspiration that did hit me on that walk, but it was just out of mind at that time. I didn't know what I was going to say. But as the week went on, then on Tuesday, they held the memorial service for Senator Wellstone and the others who died in that plane crash. And I was teaching a class that night here. So I didn't hear most of it, but when I got home and I turned on the TV just to see what was happening there, and the youngest son was speaking, and he spoke of his favorite words of his father, Paul Wellstone, which I thought was really quite inspiring, really very fitting as I thought about it, to reflect on as we now today take a little time to reflect on the precepts. Because these precepts have to do with our actions and our speech, for the most part. Also, they deal with this sense of egolessness, that maybe we can find how to live in egolessness within our lives, without anger, without vengeance, without getting back at anyone, without aggrandizing the self. But this matter of speech and action, it's the first five precepts are all full of that. The precept of not to kill seems like a precept of dealing with action, not to kill. But it's also dealing with speech, because we can kill things with our speech. So all these precepts really have to deal with both speech and action together. And what Paul Wellstone had said, what his son had quoted of him, I wrote it down here, maybe I should pull it up so I don't get it wrong. But he had said, his father always said this, Paul Wellstone always said this, never separate the lives you live from the words you speak. Never separate the lives you live from the words you speak. And I thought that was pretty good. That's really how we should understand and take these precepts, I think. Even though we might speak in flowery words or whatever to please someone else, I mean, that's all very well and good. But what are our motives and what kind of action follows from that? We can't lose sight of this. We need to hold all of this together. That in Zen practice, you know, we really are, if we're really taking this up seriously as a Zen student, we really are looking at the lives that we're living, how we conduct our lives, which is what the precepts are all about. That we take that time to observe our speech and action, to observe our motive, to observe what's taking place within our own mind as we're interacting with others. And these things cannot be separated from each other. We speak this way to this group and that way to that group. Or that we speak in such a way and then we act differently. This is all very important. And in so many different ways, people want to know, what is the Buddhist way to rear children, for example? Of course, a very common way is that we indoctrinate children. We tell them how they should think, how they should behave. It's something that's just kind of imposed upon them. But we overlook the most important aspect that they're picking up, certainly. And that is that they are observing how we live. And if they see that we speak one way and act another, or speak this way to this group and differently to them, they pick up on that. That is what they're learning. And whatever it is that we tell them, all the good lofty thoughts and ideals and things, not to lie, not to steal, etc., that we tell them mean nothing. If we ourselves aren't really acting, living out what it is that we say. And that we say, and what we say is matched by how we ourselves act and how we conduct ourselves. So this is very important. Otherwise, we really don't understand the meaning of the precepts. We don't understand the practice. And if somehow we think maybe we will find our way to enlightenment without ever really taking note of how we're actually living from moment to moment, this is just really our own fantasy, our own imagination, our own vanity, our own interest in self. We really have to, through these precepts and through understanding these precepts in this practice, we really have to take into account what this whole matter of being concerned with the precepts and how we conduct our lives is involved with this matter of others. That we have to take into account that we live with others. This whole matter of politics is really about that. Wellstone also said, just thought of this, that politics isn't about money and power necessarily. It's about the improvement of the lives of people. That whole area of politics, it should be involved. This is how we should engage each other in views of totality. But of course we don't, because of our grasping minds, not noticing how we conduct ourselves and carry on. We splinter the world. We splinter ourselves into different groups, different factions. This is what politics seems to become. It's partisan. But actually, you know, we live in this world of totality. We live in this world of wholeness. And we shouldn't lose sight of that. I think it was kind of unfortunate. I didn't see this for myself, but I heard at that memorial that there were times when, say, pictures of Trent Lott came up on that big screen, that people were, because I guess they had shots of different, you know, celebrities or whatever that were in the audience. When Trent Lott or, I don't know, some of the other Republicans came up on the screen, that there was some booing that went on. Well, you know, not only is this just bad form, not conducive to any kind of understanding among people or getting along or working with others. I think in that particular case, I suspect it was even kind of besmirching Paul Wellstone himself, who I don't think would have carried on in that way. My understanding was that he learned to get along with his adversaries there in the Senate, and that people on both sides of the aisle, as they say, had a lot of respect for him. Well, of course, this would come about if we truly do know how to act and speak and keep this consistent. That people know where we are, where we stand, and that we show some respect for someone who might have opposing views. Even if the person is a despicable person, be very careful to determine that. But even if this were the case, we still need to respect that other, because they were there. That if we spit in someone else's face because they are so despicable, that they are a mass murderer, say, whatever. But this just doesn't bring us anywhere. It just keeps the pain, the suffering, the fraction, the fractured world rolling along as it does. We have to, through these precepts, I think, really take into account how we're carrying on, how we conduct ourselves, how we're living our lives, and what this really means for us in the world. Well, that day, many people were somewhat upset with that tragedy on that Friday, and Mary Sullivan, who's the Doan, Friday Night Doan, she wanted to know, every Friday night we recite, we've been reciting the Fukan Zenge every Friday, and then lately, on occasion now, we'll be reciting the Xinqing Ming as well. But she thought maybe for this occasion, maybe something else. And I thought for a bit, and I thought maybe I could come up with something. And I found this this recitation here of the all-sightedness of the Bodhisattva, regarder of the cries of the world, which I thought really Paul Wellstone was that sort of guy, that he could hear the cries of the world. He could hear the pain and suffering of many people. But I think he learned while in office to even expand this into hearing the cries and the suffering of those that were actually, you know, opposed to him as well. And thus he was able to kind of open up. I remember when he first became a senator, he said he was going to be in Jesse Helms' face all the time, you know. But within a couple of years, he had made friends with Jesse Helms. That's great. Now maybe you can get something done. It doesn't mean we have to agree with Jesse Helms, or that Jesse Helms has to agree with Paul Wellstone. But this is the world we live in. It's muddy water. We shouldn't think it's ever going to be otherwise. But within this muddy water, we have to learn to live in such a way that we don't keep stirring it up. And this is what the precepts will help us do. But also, here's this Bodhisattva, the regarder of the cries of the world, the all-sightedness of this Bodhisattva. Because if we truly do hear the cries of the world, if we really understand what it is that we're hearing, then this all-sightedness has to be taking place within our mind. Once we go to one side, this is the pain of the world. Because now we think, here's the good stuff here. Yeah, okay, maybe under these circumstances, this is good. You know, the people over here are good. And those over there, well, now what are they? Evil? Bad? Or are they confused? Or they're thinking a different way? Don't they have any good ideas at all? This is human suffering. It is confusion and delusion. And that somehow we need to, within our own minds, to rise above all of this and to see the all-sightedness of the situation. That there are many, many different aspects here, all that need to be taken into account. And in this way, then if you find someone who is confused, misguided, you know, if in fact you have a clearer view of what's taking place here, now maybe you can help that person to see better. I understand too, this was Wellstone's way. He was always convinced he could change anybody's mind if they just would be reasonable and look at the facts. Far better than to spit in their face or to insult them or to boo them. You know, so this is the all-sightedness of the Bodhisattva, regarder of the cries of the world. The one who can actually heal the wounds of a suffering world. Well, that's what we're talking about here. And this regarder of the cries of the world, in some ways it was reminiscent in my mind of someone like a Paul Wellstone. But it isn't any particular person, you know. And it isn't somebody removed from you. And if we think of it in this way, that there's someone out there who will act in this way, but they're different from all of us. This is a Bodhisattva, maybe a mythical figure, a human ideal of some kind. But then once again, we don't understand what this little sutra is saying here. I'm just going to read this. It's quite interesting, but it's easily misunderstood. But this is one of the reasons I do want, for the few people who were here that Friday night, I want to help you out because you could easily misunderstand this one. World-honored one, addressing the Buddha, let me now again inquire of him, why is this Buddha child named regarder of the cries of the world? The world-honored one replied, listen to the deeds of the cry regarder, who well responds to every quarter, whose vast vow is deep as the sea throughout eons beyond reckoning. Serving many millions of Buddhas, the cry regarder has vowed a great pure vow. Let me briefly tell you, those who hear, see, and bear cry regarder unremittingly in mind will be able to end the sorrows of existence. Though others with harmful intent throw them into a burning pit, let them think of the cry regarder's power and the fire pit will become a pool. Now, this is what I want to say, because we think, okay, yeah, you're in this situation. People want to do you harm. They want to throw you into a burning pit. And you know, you think of the cry regarder's power. Now, there's two ways that we can take this. We can think, you see yourself enclosed in your ego and you're being harmed, you're being threatened. But you think of this cry regarder, this savior out there who's going to save you. and this fire pit will become like a pool. Well, that's nice. That's fine if you can believe something like that. And usually this is where our minds go. But you see, our minds are still enclosed in an ego. The world is still fractured. There are the good guys and the bad guys. That's one way to understand this. It's just to keep putting it back in our usual form, where we do honor to a man like Wellstone and yet boo Trent Lott. We don't understand. And in that case, I don't think we even understand the mind of Paul Wellstone. But we don't understand reality. We don't understand the situation that we're in. And we don't understand how to get out of this fire pit. We carry on in that way. So here's another way you can look at this. That this cry regarder, you think of the power of, what does it say here? Let them think of the cry regarder's power. Okay, the cry regarder's power. And the fire pit will become like a pool. Let them think of the cry regarder's power not as something, this isn't about something separate and apart from you. We're talking about your own mind. And within your own mind, you can see this all-sidedness, this understanding, this realizing of the confusion of that other, even if they want to do you harm. You yourself, your own mind has expanded outside of yourself, out of your own petty concerns of self, and reach out there in such a way that not only have you alleviated the great pain, because this great pain is that pain of divisiveness, of intentional action, intentional harm. You've eliminated this already now within your own mind. And as a result of that, you're not going to suffer in the way in which we ordinarily suffer when we think we're being assaulted by someone else or harmed or, you know, something of that sort. No, you've eliminated this problem. And not only that, you are now in a position where possibly you can even actually affect the confusion of that other person out there. So this is under the understanding of the cry regarder, that we don't think of the cry regarder or any of these bodhisattvas that we speak of from time to time as somebody else out there with magical powers. No, at any moment you yourself can become this bodhisattva. It's simply a matter of understanding a realization that is taking place within your own mind, that you become the cry regarder. And what does this entail? It entails this all-sidedness of mind. And in so doing, these pains that it describes here are eliminated all at once. So I want to say that now before I go any further with this. Otherwise, we will probably just keep taking this up in the ordinary way, that there's something else out there that's going to fix it right, save us, something we can cling to and run to. This is really not the understanding, but to realize that when we're speaking of the bodhisattva cry regarder, this is you. You can have a mind like this. It's right there. You just need to recall that, bring yourself back to that. When you think of the power of the cry regarder, this is what we're talking about. Or the bodhisattva of compassion or wisdom. So let them think of the cry regarder's power and the fire pit will become a pool. Or driven across a great ocean in peril of the deep, let them think of the cry regarder's power and waves cannot submerge them. Or if from the peak of a high mountain they were hurled down, let them think of the cry regarder's power and like the sun they will stand firm in the sky. Or if pursued by those who wish them harm, they were hunted down, let them think of the cry regarder's power, and not a hair shall be harmed. Or if meeting with encompassing foes, each with sword drawn to strike them, they think of the cry regarder's power, and all their enemies will turn to kindness. Or if meeting suffering by unjust powers, their lives are brought to an end, they think of the cry regarder's power, and the executioner's might will break into pieces. Or if in prison, shackled and chained, arms and legs and fetters and stocks, they think of the cry regarder's power, and freely they shall be released. Or if encompassed by wild beasts with sharp tusks and fearful claws, they think of the cry regarder's power, and at once none will dare harm them. Or if scorched by fire, flame, or venomous snakes, they think of the cry regarder's power. Instantly all threats retreat. And when clouds, thunder, and lightning flashes, they think of the cry regarder's power, and storms at once are scattered. The living crushed and harassed, oppressed by countless pains, the cry regarder with matchless wisdom can save the suffering of the world. This is the only way. This is the only way the suffering of the world is saved, is through this all-sidedness of mind. But it is that you yourself, when you think of this power, you have to turn your mind to that and to get outside of your small, petty self for the sake of the world. The cry regarder with matchless wisdom can save the suffering of the world. Perfect in power and practiced in wisdom, there is no place the cry regarder does not appear. All painful states by degrees are ended by the cry regarder. True regard, serene regard, far-reaching, wise regard, regard of pity, compassionate regard, ever longed for, ever looked for, pure and serene, the Son of Wisdom. This is the S-U-N, Sun, the sun in the sky. The Son of Wisdom destroys all darkness and subdues the woes of the world. Compassion, wondrous as a great cloud, pours rain to quench the flames of distress. In disputes or battles, if one thinks of the cry regarder's power, all enemies will be routed. There isn't any foe, you know, they are. Because it is a matter of seeing it that way in your mind and transforming that all within your own mind. O wondrous voice of the cry regarder, voice of the rolling tide, voice all world surpassing, ever to be kept in mind. Ever to be kept in mind. We can't lose sight of this. Perfect in all merit, with compassionate, in other words, perfect. This is the way that we come to enlightenment, to realizing this is merit, that which is conducive to awakening. With compassionate eyes, beholding all, boundless ocean of blessing, let us honor the regarder of the cries of the world. Well, I thought of this this little sutra here when Mary had called, and so we recited that. But I just wanted, for the sake of the few who were there and maybe didn't understand it, I wanted to clarify it. But I think for all of us on this day, it might be helpful to consider that. Well, yeah. I think that's all I want to say, but maybe you have a question or two or a comment. Yeah.
I was wondering if you had any comments on the word power throughout that.
Power, yeah.
Language being so ineffective, really, in getting across what's really going on.
Yeah.
And being so subject to interpretation and, you know, former experience, the word power to me seems too strong almost in that case, and I tend to want to feel like it would be the more appropriate word might be something like strength or presence. Presence. Do you have, I don't know the origins of the word power, take with it all this other stuff.
Right, and that's another thing too we should be ever mindful of, is that we pick up words. David used that term once, nerf words. You know, treat all words as nerf words, you know. So when they're lobbed at you, they don't, oh, man, you know, it's just a nerf word. It's just, you know, those nerf balls, you know, it isn't really going to hurt you. So, and we kind of lock on to our own definitions. And how we use it, of course, when we think of power, like political power, you know, to oppress others, you know, and that sort of thing. And that's one way of looking at power. But power really, like in the case of, in terms of physics, for example, power is that which can get the work done. It does work. And so it is that which is effectual, you know, that's effective in bringing about some kind of change. And in this case, the term is just simply referring to that when you think of this kind of mind, this all-sightedness of mind, of this bodhisattva, one who truly regards the cries of the world in an effective way. You know, this, now you can deal with this, you can actually heal this. That with this mind has the power, the ability, you know, to be able to bring about this kind of change. Without this all-sightedness of mind, that power, that ability to bring about the actual healing of the world is just not there. It just simply is not there at all. And it's the perpetuation of the suffering and the pain. Even though we move into it with all good intentions in our own heart, we really want to end this. We want to bring about justice and goodness and all of these kinds of things. We're, with purity of heart, we enter into it. But if we're still confused, if we're still thinking in terms of divisiveness of them and us, you know, we just don't understand the power that will actually bring about the kind of change that we seek. So power in that sense, not power in terms of the way that we commonly think of one side has power over another. But again, to this sutra was originally written in Sanskrit, and that's just a translation of the word, and maybe there could have been other words that could have been used. Again, we associate with words that we're attached to. It means this, and I don't like that word, But again, remember, it's a nerf word. All words are nerfy. They don't really have the substance and the solidity that we give them. So I think with bearing all of that in mind, maybe we can let that word soften up a little bit. And it really just means, if you look at the sutra, all it means is that we're talking about that which can actually bring about this change. That's all it refers to there. Yeah, Melody.
Well, bring about change, and what I thought out of the sutra is to not be judgmental and to respect.
Mm-hmm.
Well, could you just say something about how you carry that through with the snipers? How do you bring about change, and how do you respect? How do you not judge people like that?
It's not necessary to, I don't know what you mean by judge for sure, but they're bad. Yeah. Those guys are bad. Yeah. Yeah. Sure. Yeah. Well, no, I think you can help that. Well, they are what? See, they are confused. They are they're sick. They're crazy. We could say that, but I don't know how useful these things are. But I think we can, if we start adding on a little extra stuff to it, we could say they're confused, but we can add on other things like, that they're bad, they're crazy, they're sick. We're loading up extra stuff here, and it isn't helpful for the situation. And in fact, it brings about the kinds of conditions that we set for ourselves that end up, kind of facilitating this twistedness of mind that comes about within human society. So it's not helpful to look at it in those terms. But certainly, yeah, this isn't. We can't have people going around sniping like that. It's very dangerous. It's just we can't have it. So we have to find a way to bring it to an end. We have to find them and stop them from doing it. Society has that, but we don't need to then torture them, call them names, do any of these other kinds of things. We just need to prevent them from doing it anymore, and maybe finding a way to help them get over whatever it is that drove them to do this. But that only comes about. It isn't going to come about by calling them names or spitting on them. Like, for example, we brought in all these guys down there at Guantanamo Bay. I don't know how the prisoners were being treated. We hear things like the Al-Qaeda people or people in other lands are saying, yeah, they're being tortured or whatever. They've been mistreated in some way. Well, maybe, maybe not. But I would really hope not. Because the best thing we can do is to treat them humanely. If we really want to show these people, we feel threatened by them. They're threatening us, and they're so bad, and they're so evil. Well, but if we're going to treat them badly, all it does is confirm what they already think. The best thing is, and it's not an easy thing to do, particularly if you're really confronted with someone who really has directly caused you some pain and some harm. Very difficult to do. But as a society, maybe you aren't the one who needs to deal with these people because you're too emotionally, personally tied to some tragic event, say, or something. But as a society, we can learn to be, compassionate and to, without labeling and condemning, But if somebody's dangerous, certainly they have to be removed, stopped, prevented from carrying on. We want to bring about like with that Tim McVeigh, that was going on there. And people wanted to give him the ultimate punishment, the death penalty. Is that the ultimate punishment? For Tim McVeigh, well, how do we know what goes on now? Is it all over now? Is it bliss? Where's Tim McVeigh now? So that's kind of, you're imagining something. You're imagining it the way we think of this. Boy, that's how it is. And man, let's just do it to him, you know. And then there were people who lost loved ones in the collapse of that building there in Oklahoma City, who afterward, I remember I saw this where they said, I thought that I would feel some kind of, I'd feel better about this. I'd feel some kind of closure or something, like that, but I don't. They didn't feel any better at all. In fact, they felt worse. That it didn't bring about any kind of end, for them. But these are things that we really need to look at, to digest, to look it through, to see it through. And most of all, what we're looking at with this, to consider the power of the cry regarder. What are we looking at? We're looking at that all-sightedness of mind. And it's to the extent that we can bring ourselves out of our own little fractured view, our one-sided view, and bring ourselves out of that. To that extent, we're not going to suffer. To that extent, we can begin to heal the wounds of the world. And maybe slowly we can, to the extent that we can help others to see in this way, gradually, if enough of us see this way, we can actually bring about a just society. Just think about what we could do as human beings if we were all fair and just. We lived in economic justice, we all have a decent education and, equal opportunity at every turn. Where we don't destroy and pollute and all the rest of this. It could be a blissful place we could create for this. It's quite possible. I don't expect that anytime soon or even ever. But we do have it within our power to do that. But it isn't going to come about by any kind of one-sided kind of thinking. That just perpetuates what we have. In the meantime, our technology, our ability to destroy and to cause havoc, increases. It's not a good situation. But how are we going to find our way out of this? I think regarding the power of this cry regarder, to understand that and to see that. That's why this really is a powerful sutra. It's very interesting because it's really touching down to something very deep within us. But even here in this language, as I said, I think it could easily be misunderstood. Well, we're just looking to that out there that's going to save us. Oh, cry regarder, help me. No. It's talking about to realize this mind within yourself. This is how we obtain the power to turn the fire pit into a pool. Anything else? Thank you.